The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Question for you. Is the Champions League the place to learn to leave two defenders back when you've got a corner? Or at least one? Although Denver Bar versus Nemanja Matic is the race we all needed to see. We've got another great chance to discuss the handball law as Chelsea benefit from one of those infuriating decisions. PSG go full PSG as Julian Nagelsmann dresses down for victory. And there are wins for Barca, Juve and Dortmund. There's a fun Nat Lofthaus goal in the Championship, a Premier League preview, the deep dive you all need on pressing. We'll take your questions as well. And that's today's Guardian Football Week. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Good morning, Natasha Henry.
Good morning.
Hello, Johnny Liu.
Hi, Max. You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. You all right?
I'm fine, yeah. I mean, same with everyone else, really. Just, following the election and we're lucky to live in a time where we have so many thousands of US political experts surrounding us to kind of convey their take on this momentous event. I mean, we're really blessed with so much expertise at a time like this.
I'm just trying to work out how many times I've given my take over the last 24 hours. But, you know, it's interesting. What's interesting, Johnny, it's not only am I an expert on US politics, I'm also an epidemiologist. So I've got everything covered. Anyway, one of my hobbies is watching football, so we should probably crack on with that. We'll start with Manchester United's defeat at the hands of Istanbul Başakşehir, their first ever win in the Champions League. Jamie Jackson said Manchester United were close to a rabble throughout, a dire display that poses serious questions about where their season is heading. The first goal for Istanbul is blown my mind, right? Joey Hepp says, have you ever seen anything like Manchester United's defending for the first goal? I've not seen that in a Sunday league game from lads that got smashed the night before. Smithy says, when I was 10, I was super quick. And my coach used to say, stand on the halfway line, we'll boot it to you. After a while, the defenders forgot I was there as they followed the ball. I scored about 100 goals that season. Jonathan, you are a tactically astute follower of the game. Jonathan Wilson, yes. I mean, you both, obviously, Jonathan, you are as well. But I defer to tactics man Wilson. How has that happened?
I've got absolutely no idea. I think there's a basic problem with Solskjaer that hasn't, you know, he's been in charge 101 games now, and it's been a problem throughout, that when they can sit deep and play on the break, they're very, very good. And so that's why they'd won 10 away games in a row before last night, why he's beaten Guardiola three times, why he's beaten PSG twice away, why he gets those good results. But as soon as he comes up against a team that sits deep against him, there's no coordinated plan of attacking. And so that's why they've lost twice at home to Crystal Palace. It's why they looked so inadequate against Sevilla in the Europa League semi-final last year. And it's why they looked so bad last night. Not just in terms of the defending on both goals were shambolic. The incident where Twanzebe got booked for pulling Bar back, which could easily have been a red card. Just a simple ball over the top. They couldn't deal with it. And I think there is a tendency, because they don't have the sophistication of approach, to overcommit men forward. But that still doesn't explain why you do it at a corner. I mean, a corner is the easiest thing. You know, a set play should be easy to set up, to know you have to keep men back, to know that having Nemanja Matic as your deepest player 70 yards, maybe 80 yards from your goal, is asking for trouble. And even a 35-year-old Denver Bar is going to win a race against Nemanja Matic.
Natasha, he's like, Demba Ba is 6'2", and he's in a bright orange kit. It's like you've got to be able to spot him.
I do feel like sometimes there feels like there's an arrogance to some of Man United's play, just not paying attention to, you know, it's only Demba Ba. He doesn't play in the Premier League anymore. He's maybe not up to that standard, and just not being aware of their surroundings. And that always feels like there's such a disorganisation with them. Like, we were talking about cakes before. With baking, you need to measure out your ingredients. There needs to be some common sense to who does what and who goes where, in the same way that flour, self-raising flour, makes your cake rise. You watch Man United and you're like, does anyone know what they're doing? You know, do they know who they're marking? Even if your manager's not telling you to do something, you're a professional footballer in the most watched league in the world, you should know where your attacker is.
Natasha, you're really pulling back the curtain there of the fascinating pre-pod chat. Honestly, I've watched it so many times. I can't stop. I just can't believe anyone would be like it's not just one man back. If there's a striker up there at my level, right, it would be unforgivable. I'm trying to work out at what age you would forgive a team. Because at under 14s, you'd say, that's ridiculous. At under 12s, would you go, okay, they're only 11. Maybe they haven't got used to this. I don't know if I'm going overboard here. I don't be accused of hyperbole. It's just, it's so abject.
I think 11 at one end of the scale is about right. And I guess maybe sort of mid 70s at the other end of the scale. Once you get to that age, you know, I think the peripheral vision sort of slightly fails you a bit. But I'm no expert. It does feel.
You'd probably still notice Demba Ba, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you probably. I mean, you probably would. I feel like it's one of those things, not to kind of stick up for Manchester United defending here, but it feels like potentially one of those things that looks a lot worse than it is. It's not that it happens straight from a corner. There's kind of a couple of phases of play straight after that. And I think Matic sort of gets sucked into maybe trying to provide a passing option. And then the move breaks down, and then because, you know, Nemanja Matic then has to turn, which means he has to think about, you know, which part of his body he's going to turn first, and you know, by the time that's happened, football is such a kind of a quick moving game these days that the two or three seconds that it takes for the ball to land, then the ball's already away, and it looks like he's in sort of 20, 30 yards of space, and it just looks terrible. Which is not to kind of excuse that sort of defending. It's just the fact that it could look worse than it does. It's just a momentary lapse of concentration. But I don't know. It does sound like I'm sticking up for them, which I'm not, because it is all so abject.
Yeah, I mean, you say football is, you know, it is a very quick game. Perhaps Demba Ba versus Nemanja Matic isn't the quickest part of the game. Barney Ronno saying, you know, the best bit is a 40-metre foot race between flying machines, Ba and Matic. Elite sport should have more on this. He says the New Zealand cricket team used to get Mark Richardson to race the slowest man from the opposition at the end of every test series, which is sort of bullying. There was a famous duel with Darren Lehman. This is pretty much what's happened here. I suggested what other races we could have. Stuart said Jan Molby versus Charlie Adam. Ian went for Berbatov versus Pirlo. Basil Gunnar, what about a lanky race of Per Mertesacker versus Peter Crouch? And Stephen went Akinfenwa versus Captain Tom.
It was very Biden v. Trump, wasn't it? Like, you know, it took so long. People were calling it. I'm calling this one for Demba Ba. We project that Demba Ba. You know, it's still a long way to go. Just wait for all the steps to be run. But we project at this moment that Demba Ba is going to win that race first. But you know, this could take until Thursday.
I mean, I've heard people saying this is, you know, it's a sort of crisis of leadership at Manchester United, Natasha. Is that, are we overanalyzing just one moment of stupidity? Or do you look at the whole game and think there is a crisis of leadership there? Or not just with Solskjaer, but sort of on the pitch as well?
Yeah, I do feel like, and in the boardroom, there has been a crisis of leadership there for several years now. I mean, he's won, what, half of his games and lost 25%. That is not the numbers that a Man United manager should be looking to bring in at the end of the season. I don't think the players, I don't want to say they don't respect him, but it kind of feels like they don't a little. They don't look like, if he's coaching them, then they're clearly not doing the job that he wants them to do, because he's regularly coming out and saying that he's disappointed in them. And then if he's not coaching them, then he's definitely not the man for the job. I never personally felt he was. And I just think this season's going to be interesting anyway. But if I was a Man United fan, yeah, I'd be very worried.
But like a week ago, we were celebrating what Jamie Jackson said was their sort of best performance under Solskjaer, you know, the hammering of Leipzig. So like, can we have it both ways, Wilson? Or did we go over the top then? Or should we go over the top now? Or should we...
Well, I slightly challenge the premise of the question.
How dare you?
Well, it's our question of going over the top. They do one thing really, really well, and that is sitting deep and playing on the break. And if a team loses discipline, as Leipzig did chasing that game, then they can pull off very impressive results. But every time they come up against a team that sits deep against them and is well organised, they really struggle. So, and you're not going to win the league doing that one thing. You know, it's the Isaiah Berlin thing about hedgehogs and foxes, that the fox knows many things, a hedgehog knows one thing, but it's quite a vital thing. But rolling them to ball, putting your spikes up, hedgehogs don't win leagues. They might prick the nose of a fox who's sniffing around them, but they're not going to win the title. When was the last time a hedgehog won a title? Just doesn't happen.
Wigan in the FA Cup would be the only one I could think of.
You say Wigan are a hedgehog?
Well, they were a team that weren't as accomplished as the team they were playing that day. And they didn't have as many talents as many skills. So, yeah, they used their one trick to win the FA.
I mean, there is a paradox here that the last team that was a hedgehog to win the league was actually the Foxes.
I was thinking about that. Where do you see a fox winning a league?
I don't think Isaiah Berlin thought one through, actually.
No. Anshuman says, instead of telling us how inept Solskjaer is as United manager, could Wilson tell us a bit about how the club should go ahead if and when they let him go?
They should appoint Matteo Pochettino as they should have done 2 years ago.
Johnny, agree?
Yeah, I mean, there seems this really, I mean, you see a lot of United fans and a lot of pundits on TV, you know, your Roy Keane's and your Paul Scholes saying that, like, you can't possibly, this is the players' fault, this is on the players. You can't possibly expect Ole Gunnar Solskjaer to be responsible for, you know, organising a team tactically or motivating them or producing a game plan. You know, that's not on him. This is on the players. And I sort of agree that you can't really expect Solskjaer to pull them out of this mess, but for a slightly different reason. There does seem this weird kind of urge to absolve Solskjaer of everything that's going on. To say that, yeah, okay, he's responsible for the good stuff, but he's somehow not responsible for any of the calamities that are also happening under his watch. I think, you know, we've learned very little about him in the last 12 months. We knew that he was kind of a decent motivator, kind of a good, I guess, a good politician, which is a kind of an underrated skill at an elite club these days. You sort of have to manage expectations a little bit, but tactically, no more than average. And his teams were going to play with a kind of a maddening inconsistency. We've learned nothing about them. And so it really comes down to whether the United board and whether that organisation wants to carry on this sort of two wins, two defeats, you know, some kind of vague scintilla of progress and then a massive setback. You know, that's been the story of United for, you know, years. And if they want to break that cycle, then that's kind of on them.
Well, you know, I think what's really telling is, he plays that diamond against Leipzig, gets loads of praise for it, and it worked really, really well in that game. And so he then uses it in the next game. Suddenly this is the solution. This is how he fits in as many of his midfielders and forwards as he can. But the problem is if you play a diamond against Arsenal, you're making the pitch very narrow. And so what you're doing is you're just giving Arsenal's wing-backs. You're saying to them, just control the flanks, have it, it's yours. And you're playing two centre-forwards against three centre-backs, which is exactly what Arsenal want. If you want to trouble Arsenal tactically, you play one forward against those three centre-backs and you say, well, you've got a redundant player in that position, what are you going to do about it? He got something tactically very right and then uses the right solution for the wrong problem. Suggests to me there's a lack of coherence of thought there.
Yeah, it seems like he's not looking at it in a game-by-game basis. He's just like, oh, that worked last time, so I'm going to do it again. And yes, we can blame the players, but the way the pundits are basically giving him a free pass, no other manager would get that free pass. We know why they get, because they're all mates with him. You know, they've all been very honest about that. But at the end of the day, he's the one that is picking the team. Clearly, he's not doing something right. It's not translating, whether that's from the training pitch. And maybe he's just not up to the job.
Well, then the other thing I thought was really worrying from the Arsenal game is when he acknowledges the formation is wrong and he changes to the sort of 4-2-3-1/4-3-3 hybrid, he ends up with Pogba on the left wing. Now, surely if you're making that change of shape, you have to sacrifice Pogba and you have Rashford and Greenwood wide and Cavani through the middle or whatever. But it was as if he didn't quite dare to take Pogba off.
Is it that he doesn't dare or he doesn't... No.
That's a good question. The troublesome left side of Manchester United. Also in that group, RB Leipzig beat PSG 2-1. Richard says, how much more stereotypically PSG can PSG get? Wilson, it was fun, wasn't it?
It was fun. And PSG were pretty good till they conceded the equaliser, and then they just fell apart completely. And Kimpembe's red card, the second one, was a disgusting tackle. And yeah, it should have been a straight red. It was a second yellow, but it should have been a straight red. You know, a horrible foul from behind. And it just showed the sort of petulance, the lack of discipline. And, I mean, you can say they got a bit unlucky with a modern handball decision, but in the context of a night, it wasn't the worst of those type of decisions. So, yeah, just a classic PSG meltdown.
Did you prefer Julian Nagelsmann's sort of anorak number as compared to the fancy jacket he wore? Bearing in mind, we got told off a lot for speaking about Nagelsmann's jacket more than the Football League last week.
Well, if we're going to talk about the Football League, I think we should note that Sunderland, if we win the game in hand, are 1 point off the top of League One, having won again with another late penalty. I'm not somebody to turn to for fashion, but I essentially think that if a manager wants to be taken seriously, he either wears some kind of tracksuit or sort of rugby shirt style thing, your Martin O'Neill type, or he wears a suit. And anything in between those, you're asking for trouble. And the thing that I think you know, the evidence of Guardiola losing it is wearing that, well, you know, for the second season running, he's wearing a woolen hooded thing in the rain. Wool in the rain. What's that about?
Can I say there's nothing amuses me more than the whole football media group always discussing managers' outfits. I see a lot of you. I see what you wear. Maybe you need to look in your own wardrobes first. Not Jonathan and Jonathan. There's a few others out there.
Oh, right. What about me? What am I wearing?
I can only see the shoulders up, so you're good.
Am I too old for a hoodie? I'm 41.
Never too old for a hoodie. We live in England. It's cold.
Okay.
I don't know. I think that there comes an age where this is going to sound like a very ageist podcast for me, but I think there does come an age where you can't really, if you're wearing a hoodie, not for sporting reasons or not for exercise, there's sort of a Dominic Cummings vibe to it.
Oh, God. But the thing is, no, this is a really interesting point, Johnny, because I think I need, you know, to progress my career, I need to become sort of wear a bit more authority. But I don't want to wear suits and I don't want to go Clarkson jacket and jeans. So I don't know where to go. I'm just not sure what's the next step.
Go cardigans like I have.
Sensible cardigan, yeah. Isn't it?
Like a
good cardigan, a good roll neck is always a winner.
I can't wear a roll neck. I'm not.
Why have you got a neck like Joe Hart? I'm going to be sending you examples of roll necks with jackets.
Yeah, okay, send me a Pinterest board. Chelsea 3, Rennes 0. Dale says, I'm sitting here gobsmacked at that sending off at Chelsea. Bring it up in the Guardian podcast and make them stop this silliness. We do have that power. It was Chelsea's second penalty. Dalba has already been booked for the first penalty. He's sent off for Rennes from a strike from Tammy Abraham from a yard that smashes one of Dalba's teammates' legs and bounces up into his arm. Frank Lampard admitted afterwards that the rule's been adjusted in the Premier League for common sense. If I was the manager of Rennes today, I wouldn't be happy with it either. And I didn't think anybody would think that was a penalty until I saw Gary Neville tweeting, am I the only person who thinks that should be a penalty? But Wilson, it makes me genuinely angry when I'm sitting there getting excited about Biden closing in on Nevada and Arizona, and then that penalty happens and I'm brought back into reality.
Well, there's two levels here, aren't there? So the penalty, I don't like it, and I think it ruins the game. A game that was set up relatively nicely. Your Ren were playing relatively well. Chelsea were on top, but your Ren were posing a bit of a threat. So it's progressing nicely, and then suddenly a random bounce in the box, and Chelsea get a penalty for nothing. I can just about see a case that Delvet's arms are sort of flapping about. They weren't tight into his body. And although it was in front of his body, it did hit an outstretched arm. So I can just about conceive how people think that might be a penalty while saying I don't think it should be. But the idea that should be a yellow card, the idea that that is the same level of crime as that Kimpembe foul, it's just a nonsense. And the game's made a farce. And, you know, it ends up, you know, Chelsea probably would have won that game, and we could have been sitting here this morning saying, oh, it's another good result for Chelsea, they're starting to play a bit better. But we can't say that because they got two penalties, one of which was a joke, and they end up playing for more than half the game against 10 men. So it just tells us nothing.
I think what I find frustrating is the idea that if your hands are anywhere away from your body, that it's unnatural. Whereas I was workshopping it in the living room. If you stretch one way, if you naturally, I'm going to stand up for this and probably won't be here, but if you stretch, if you like lean out one way, your arm, it naturally goes out. It doesn't stay by your side. That is not natural. It's not physics.
Yeah, I completely agree. And especially when it's a deflection. I mean, there's no way. Yeah, if that was a goalkeeper who'd made that save, you'd have been hailing it as one of the greatest saves of all time. There's no way he could have reacted in time to put his hand there. His hand's right in front of his body, so there's no sense he's gained advantage by sort of stretching out to make the surface area bigger. I mean, how often do we say it? But it's just a farce. And the yellow card adds a whole new level of depravity to it.
But you know these days, as a defender, that you have to, under the new rules, you don't take the risk of having your arms... You put your hands behind your back. We're increasingly seeing defenders in the area, wherever they are in the area. If a shot's about to be taken or a cross is about to come in, you put your arms behind your back. It's the only safe way of doing it. And I think this is doubly true when the ball sort of pinging about, because you know that the possibility... You have to... And defenders are going to go, I guess, learn this with experience, that the possibility for a freak deflection that is going to change the course of the game is so great that why would you take the risk
But sort of listen to that sentence. It's ridiculous. I mean, you're right, but it's ridiculous that is what defenders have to do.
Aren't we asking defenders to go against their natural instinct? All of a sudden, you played this way for 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden now every time there's a free kick or the ball's coming in, you've got to remember, oh my God, my hands are behind my back. That's not natural human nature.
Well, it's not even just a football thing, is it? It's kind of whatever. If you're walking down the street and a pigeon flaps up at you, your hands instinctively go up.
Yeah. Referees have to have some common sense. That, you know, like you said about the yellow card, it can't be the same as an awful tackle. There has to be some time for people to get used to the rules rather than just, yeah, this is what we're doing, because it's not a natural thing. And everyone takes time to actually pick things up and remember to put your hands behind your back.
But it's not, I don't think it's referees should have common sense. It's IFAB need to, or whoever, it, you know, like IFAB need to go, hang on a second, this isn't what it should be. I know we've repeated, you know, like, I know people listening to this will have heard us talk about this a million times, but somebody who makes the rules of football has to go, hang on a second, there cannot be a situation where that has such a direct impact on that football match. It goes completely against what the point of any of this is. Anyway, should we talk about Chelsea for a second? Lots of Chelsea fans, Wilson, want you to eat some humble pie.
For what?
To talk about, well, that's 5 clean sheets in a row, 6 clean sheets in 7 for Mendy. Chelsea stuff says, I'd like to hear at length from Wilson about Lampard's inability to impose defensive structure, organise at cross-step plays, prevent counter-attacks. Feel we might hear less from him than normal on those topics, smiley face.
Well, they clearly have got better over the last month. They've clearly got a lot better since Mendy came in. They've had a pretty straightforward run of fixtures. I mean, who are those clean sheets against? I mean, Sevilla, okay. Yeah, Sevilla have a decent side, but they struggle for goals in La Liga. And Chelsea offered little of attacking threat there. They kept a clean sheet against United by not venturing out of their half. They kept a clean sheet against Burnley. I mean, okay, it's better to have a clean sheet than not, but none of that really convinces me. Come back to me, I think they've got a relatively easy run till the end of the month when they play Tottenham, I think the last weekend in November. So I think that'll be the first test as to whether this is sustainable or not. And if it is, great. I think you should be able to keep clean sheets against 10-man Ren.
Luke says, is there a better centre-back partnership in England right now than Thiago Silva and Kurt Zouma?
They've done very well against Burnley. Congratulations.
Sevilla beat Krasnodar 3-2. What a game this was. From 2-0 down, they were with 10 men when they were 2-1 down. Navas sent off. That's sort of unlucky, but right decision. But they came back. I mean, some terrible defending from Kaio at 2-1. They're 2-1 up. Krasnodar, like they're playing 10 men. It's such a great opportunity for them to get a win, and he just sort of dallies about with it. It's madness.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very, very strange game. In that, I've got no idea how they were 2-1 up and with a man up at half time, because Sevilla battered them. I think it was 12 shots to 3 at half time to Sevilla. It's a brilliant free kick and a penalty, but they basically scored the twice they ventured forward. So I kind of, even when they're down to 10 men, I sort of did think Sevilla might get back into it. And they absolutely battered them second half.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the Nou Camp. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's rattle through the rest of the Champions League games. Barcelona beat Dinamo Kiev 2-1. Dinamo Kiev's 18-year-old Ruslan Nesteret was called up from their B team due to both first-team goalkeepers testing positive for COVID-19. He had a really good game, but Ter Stegen also had a really good game. And Jonathan, I thought Barcelona were quite lucky to win this game.
Yeah, I mean, they were obviously hanging on a little bit at the end, and it was very far from convincing. I saw them win at Juventus last week. And that felt like it could be a little catalyst for them, a little kickstart. But I think they're four without a win in La Liga, and it just seems like an extremely unhappy place. I mean, I don't know. There's a heaviness to them. Obviously, that the Messi thing is still rumbling on, and they can't really seem to get their game going, and there's all this uncertainty over now the presidential election, and it just seems like a club where. People aren't very happy, and people are kind of grumbling and sort of carrying this sort of funk around them, and I think that's translating onto the pitch. I mean, they're looking pretty good in their Champions League group, but they're actually really not showing too many encouraging signs for the future.
But you see how badly things have gone wrong. If you just look at their side, and it's full of kids and 30-somethings. There's nobody at the peak of their career anymore. It's this sort of, in Argentina, they call it the talent donut. Because Argentina, you have kids coming through, then they get sold to Europe, and then they come back when they're in their 30s. And Barcelona seem to be doing the same thing. That, there's nobody between the ages of, 23 and 30 who's any good there.
I like, Johnny, how your young baby timed bursting into tears. As you said, Barcelona was an unhappy place. It's your daughter, isn't it? Is she obviously very upset about what's happening at the Camp Nou.
Yeah, I know. She's kind of distraught.
she was one of the few people that really liked Bartomeu, right?
Yeah, she was a big Bartomeu fan. She just doesn't want Xavi back. She thinks that would be a retrograde step. The thing about Barca's recruitment is that there was supposed to be this whole generation of the new players that I guess would be mid to late 20s now, people like Coutinho and Dembele was also supposed to be part of this new generation, and for one reason or another they just kind of screwed up their recruitment for a few years, and so now you do have this kind of talent donut, which seems like a very delicious Argentinian concept. It's a really uneven team. They do have a lot of really good young players coming through. I mean, I will say that. I mean, the likes of Fati and Dest and Pedri, who looks like a real find. They do seem to have that coming through. But if they are being forced to, anchor a team that is totally unbalanced and totally kind of bereft of ideas, that's going to be a huge responsibility on them. And I don't know if that's the best environment for them to grow into.
I think we have to make sure, as a podcast in general, that we make sure that we don't become victim of the talent donut situation. It's very worrying. Also in that group, Juve won 4-1 at Ferencvaros. Morata scored a couple. His second was a lovely finish. And then Dybala was just gifted two goals by some utterly hilarious defending. In Group F, Zenit had an injury time winner, chalked off for offside as they drew with Lazio, and Dortmund won 3-0 in Bruges. Erling Haaland got another couple. He scored 14 in 11 Champions League appearances, has 26 in 28 for Dortmund across all competitions. He is sort of utterly ludicrous centre forward. Europa League, Jeremy says, I know its timing is deliberately inconvenient for Football Weekly, but are you ever going to mention the Europa League? I mean, probably not until it gets to about the quarterfinals. Jose's hit back about Harry Kane being clever in earning that penalty against Brighton in a 3.5 minute soliloquy, accused Spurs' rivals of diving, said Adam Lallana was reckless for jumping into Kane. You could be speaking about some Chelsea players and you're speaking about Harry Kane. They are speaking to you, Jose. Don't speak about Harry Kane. Probably you're speaking about players in other clubs who love to do it and they do it so well. I actually had a chunk edited out of Monday's pod where I was not defending Harry Kane but saying Lallana actually shouldn't have gone for that ball. I've watched it loads of times because there's another clip of Kane really backing into Cresswell and it is dangerous. And I still think what Kane is doing is dangerous, but I think sometimes you can't win the ball. But maybe they'll edit that bit out again to because I sound ridiculous.
Do you want to know my take on this? I don't actually find what he does that objectionable at all. I mean, I don't actually have a huge objection to diving, which is a big, you know, a whole other topic. But I saw Werner's first penalty that he won for Chelsea last night. He leaves his leg in. You know, that's something you do as a striker. You delay your run, you leave your leg in, you make sure you get contact. And until penalties are given by referees when players don't go down, then where is the incentive to not go down? That's just, it's part of the game. You are trying to gain an advantage for your team by moving your body in a slightly deceptive way, which you know, morally is no different from kind of a step over or a feint in my book. And there's always been, you know, there's always been this slight, I guess, wooliness when it comes to the rules that, you know, it says in the rules, if you try and grapple someone down, if you try and drag them, or, you know, if you try and, you know, make some sort of contact with them, but don't get the ball, it should be, you know, it should be an infringement. But that's not the way it works. It's kind of accepted, but not codified, that if you're a defender trying to win the ball off someone, you get one go at trying to bring them down, but don't make too much of a show of it. And that's the kind of, that's the ambiguity that is now, you know, causing so much trouble, because players are now going down as a result of that contact. Well, players have always been going down because of that contact, but they wouldn't have got the penalty otherwise. So that's, you know, what are they supposed to do?
I mean, I don't necessarily agree with Johnny about that, but that's a slightly different issue. I think the problem here is that making a bridge for somebody who's jumped for a ball is really dangerous. And that's where it's different. It's not some kind of moral grey area. It's, you could dislocate their shoulder or break their neck or cause a serious head injury. And that's, you know, what we've got to be.
But there are rules in place. There was a rule in place for endangering the safety of.
But it wasn't. I mean, it doesn't seem to be applied in that case.
Until it's actioned, Kane is going to continue to do it. He's, of course, he is.
Well, that's a call for the referee.
It's a benefit to his team. So it's not about us really having a go at Kane. Those that disagree with it, it's the refs need to do something. Until they step in and start giving him a yellow card or not giving him the foul or penalty, if that's what it was, then he's going to continue to do it. And with a manager like Jose, of course he's going to encourage him to do that because it benefits the team.
No, but I think it's far worse than that. I think it should be a red card for Kane. I think it's that bad.
Elsewhere, Ryan Sessegnon, who's on loan at Hoffenheim from Spurs, says he's disgusted by the racist abuse he's been subjected to online, has shared screenshots of the messages he received on social media. Hoffenheim tweeted support for him, as did Spurs saying everyone at the club is with you. We're proud of the rich ethnic diversity that exists across our communities, fans, staff and players. We're driven by inclusion and equality for all. Nobody should have to endure such repulsive abuse. The other fixtures that will probably be played by the time you listen to this: Arsenal, Molde, Celtic, Sparta Prague, Leicester versus SC Braga, Benfica Rangers and Rapid Vienna play Dundalk. Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, there was a big game in Group I, which might just fly under the radar of some of our listeners. Sivasspor against Karabag. In the Europa League. The big news coming out of Karabag this week is that they're in Azerbaijan, Azeri team, and that what their press officer, their head of media, has been banned by UEFA after tweeting that they should kill all Armenians. He's saying we, as in the Azerbaijanis, must. He basically called for an indiscriminate genocide on all Armenians.
And that is pretty extraordinary story, isn't it? Producer Ian has found this to say UEFA moved swiftly to provisionally ban Nurlan Ibrahimov, who went on to justify the Armenian genocide committed by Turkey in 1915 and 16. While the post was later deleted, it was not before the Armenian Football Federation had been alerted and filed a complaint to UEFA. In a statement, UEFA said Nurlan Ibrahimov is provisionally banned from exercising any football-related activity with immediate effect until the UEFA Control, Ethics and Disciplinary Body decides on the merits of the case. Ibrahimov is charged with fascist and other discriminatory conduct and violating the basic rules of decent conduct. Ibrahimov said that he regrets his comments, and that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with the EFL. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. And on Monday night, Jonathan Wilson, you, me, Barney Ronne, and Barry Glendening are doing a live online show. It's like Live at the Palladium or the O2, but you don't have to leave your house. £6. It's a 7:30 start. What are you bringing to the table, Wilson? Because there are still, it's open to everyone on Earth. So there's a good sort of 6-7 billion tickets still remaining.
What am I bringing to the table? I should have some flapjacks left by then. Okay. Did a batch of flapjacks yesterday with my new oven. Very excited by that.
Yeah.
I'd very much encourage people to come because, let's be honest about this. I get a fee for this.
Yeah.
And the more people who come, the more likely we are to do it in the future.
Yeah.
And then I might get another fee. And I really like money. So please, please help.
I'm not sure that was the right. I'm not sure if that was the right pitch.
No. Well, you'll have a lovely time and we'll have some nice football chat. And
Is that like people really like the last one?
Look at the warm, charismatic people you got on the panel, Barry and Barney and me.
I'm bringing the enthusiasm, that's for sure. Barney will just be staring at the camera going, why is anybody, what are we doing here? He was upside down on yesterday's Zoom, so he may not even be the right way up. Anyway, Chris says, since you started talking about us, Reading, we haven't played well, please stop. Yeah, another defeat for Reading since I announced they got good. 3-0 at home to Preston. Mike says, what are the panel's thoughts on this goal line technology issue in last night's Watford-Stoke game? Is it the Wilson scenario for watch-based technology, the Cleverley conundrum? So Tom Cleverley strikes the ball. It hits the bar and bounces on the line, but doesn't cross the line. Angus Gunn then catches it and Pedro kind of Nat Lofthouses him into the goal and the referee's watch goes off to say the ball's crossed the line. So should we have some sympathy for the referee here that he can't be sure that the ball hasn't crossed the line from the Cleverley shot? So, and should we encourage, therefore, players to barge into goalkeepers very close to balls almost crossing the line?
I don't know. I mean, can he really not ask somebody, what's that buzz for? Which incident was that? Is that really beyond the bounds of technology to tell him that?
I mean, that's 5-10 years down the line, surely. You need kind of that's the next big technological leap forward.
Just on Watford, I really like Saša Ilić for very, very selfish reasons. So I interviewed him. This is years.
Did he give you money at some point?
He has never. Saša Ilić has never given me money. This is, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago, I was doing a piece on the Belgrade Derby and he was captain of Partizan. So I interviewed him and he was really nice, really friendly. And after the interview, we were having a chat and he was sort of trying to explain what the Derby means to him as a Partizan fan, a Partizan player. And he said to me, who do you support? And I said, Sunderland. He went, well, who's your big rivals? And I said, well, Newcastle. And he said, so if Partizan played Newcastle in UEFA Cup, who would you want to win? I said, well, Partizan, obviously. And he said, well, if that ever happens, I will try and score a goal for you. 2 years later, they do meet each other in the UEFA Cup. It goes to penalties. And who steps up to take the decisive penalty but Saša Ilić? And clearly he had in his mind, I must score this for Wilson. And he did.
FA Cup question. Damo says, probably off topic and... more for the knowledge, he says. But fallen never quite giants Ipswich and Portsmouth meet in the FA Cup first round on Saturday. Is this the first time two previous winners have met in the first round? I don't know. I don't expect anyone to know the answer. But it's a good question.
Well, presumably they did quite a lot in the early days before big teams didn't come until the third round.
I reckon they might. I reckon you would have got like a Coventry v Bury or something.
Yeah, that's possible. Yeah. If anyone knows, let us know and we'll let everyone know on Monday. For want of not being bothered to do our own research. So the men's FA Cup goes ahead, the women's FA Cup doesn't, Natasha.
I mean, just more incompetence, more ridiculous decisions. You've got a team like Lewis FC, who we need to give credit to, the first equally paid men and women's team. They play at the same stadium, they use the same facilities, yet the men's team can play their games and the women's team can't. Now, if we're basing it on the safety of the players and the officials and the media, they have the complete same setup, but the women's team are not deemed to be elite, inverted commas, and therefore they won't be able to play their games. And women's FA Cup will be postponed from this month.
Michael says, which Premier League manager is most likely to call an end to the season once they were top of the table?
Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, it's obvious, isn't it? the Premier League is using the new cold weather, a new match ball for the cold weather. Premier League tweet, icy emoji, cold weather, flames, a new match ball, the high-vis Nike Flight on pitch from WM9. It looks very similar to the other one. I presume it's rounder than ever, but I think they're playing with that this weekend, of which the biggest game is Man City-Liverpool. This is a fun one, Wilson, isn't it?
Yeah, the ball's really good, by the way. The design, as in structurally, it's really good. Okay. Like, it works, right? We had some really good football. There's loads of long-range shots are going in, and not going in because they've done some weird wobble, but because they've been controlled. It's a really, really good ball.
Excellent.
And I don't really care whether it's white or yellow, but it's a good ball for whatever reason.
What about Man City Liverpool?
Yeah, I mean, that's... it's obviously a huge game for a number of reasons. And I think it's actually it's a really telling game. I mean, basically, if Liverpool win this, I think they'll walk away with the title. I mean, they already look the most consistent side by some margin. But I think it's also quite a telling game in terms of the evolution of pressing. I think German pressing has now outstripped the sort of Spanish model. I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, there's obviously specific reasons that Barcelona and Real Madrid have to do with politics and signings and whatever. But I just sort of think their model of play has regressed. And so it's a very simple measure of that. There's no Spanish team in the semi-final of the Champions League last season for the first time since 2007. Three German coaches in the semi-final of the Champions League. Klopp is in the vanguard of the sort of German school. Guardiola is in the vanguard of the Spanish school. And I think there is a growing sense that his model of football, which was revolutionary and brilliant 10 years ago, maybe isn't quite at the very, very forefront of the game anymore.
Producer Ian says, how would you describe the difference between the two types of pressing?
Well, I would refer him to the column I'm writing in The Observer on Sunday for a more detailed explanation. But essentially, and what I find fascinating about this is these are really closely guarded secrets. So partly it's to do with to do with pace and strength and stamina. Those are the obvious things. But it's also to do with organisation. And Klopp does not let anybody watch his pressing sessions. They're done completely in secret because what he does is so... He thinks he gains such an advantage by doing it, the sophistication of it, that he doesn't want those secrets to get out. So it's very hard to know exactly what that is, but it will be to do with analysing opponents and working out specific ways of stopping each team. And sort of, each team... To give you a very, very basic example of this, do you remember... Liverpool beat Huddersfield the season before last.
No.
5-0. And one of the goals they scored was straight from kickoff. And Huddersfield knocked it about. And suddenly Liverpool burst through and scored because they had was it Naby Keita standing exactly the right place? And the reason he was standing exactly the right... I haven't explained that very well because I can't really remember it that clearly. But one of the reasons it happens is that he knows where the pass is going to be played. He knows that internal shape. And a kickoff is a very easy way of doing that because you remove a lot of the parameters first. But for every team, Liverpool and the other teams who are really good at pressing will understand the internal dynamic of that team. They'll understand their common patterns of passing and it'll make sure that they interrupt them. And even if they don't necessarily get the ball directly from that, that will interrupt the fluency and flow of the opposition. And that, I think, is something that for lay people is very, very hard. And I include myself in that as a layperson. I mean somebody outside the club.
You aren't really, though, are you?
No, no. What I mean by that is somebody who's not privy to those discussions. It's very hard to pick that up from the outside looking in. Whereas I think if you were in those training sessions and you knew that, Sadio Mane had been told... When he passes there and he moves there, you go here. I think you would see that happen all the time.
Yeah, it's partly about choke points, isn't it? It's about identifying opponents on the ball and areas of the pitch where you then, that's like once the ball goes into that area or once the ball goes to that player, that's a trigger for various players to go and do their moves. And I think there's, a lot of teams kind of employ that, but I mean that there's also a sense to which I remember that Huddersfield game, now you mentioned it, but you press an opponent from a specific angle and then, which then kind of forces them into,
taking the ball in a certain where you've then laid a trap for them. I think it's almost sort of that intricate. It's like a chain reaction of things that you sort of mapped out in advance.
Yeah, that's it. It's not just one or two players going. It's essentially the whole team taking up the right disposition to block off every angle to force them to go where you want them to go. So, and I think that it is really intricate. And I think because of its intricacy and sophistication, it can go really badly wrong really quickly. And that's it's really high risk. So the Villa game, for instance, for Liverpool this season, was an example of something went wrong in that mechanism. And then the whole thing falls apart, because once one little cog isn't quite functioning, none of the other cogs can function properly either. So that's why I think it's a fascinating way of playing. And it's a fascinating thing to be witnessing. And I just sort of think that Liverpool do it better than City at the minute. Sorry, just on City, and sort of, again, this is a very sort of blunt example of what I'm talking about, but the Leicester game for City, so Guardiola was clearly worried about the middle of his defence. So he played with two deep-lying central midfielders to protect them, which makes sense. But the problem is, as soon as you do that, you're taking a player out of the press, or out of the first line of the press. So De Bruyne in that game kept on pressing alone, and then that allowed Mendy and Tielemans to have a fraction more time, because they're only being pressed by one player rather than two. And that was why they were able to build play. Clearly not all players are going to be able to do that. You have to be as good as those two are. And I think give Rodgers credit as well that he recognised that and anticipated it. But by trying to protect the middle of his defence, Guardiola then created problems with the press out of the pitch. That a decision at one end of the pitch has profound ramifications at the other.
Are you finished?
Yeah, sorry, did I bore you?
One of the things, kind of a related thing, one of the things we've seen this season, like for example with the Aston Villa game or Manchester City Leicester, is teams for reasons I think of concentration as much as kind of physical reasons, aren't able to maintain their full level for 90 minutes, and then games get lost in like a really mad 10-15 minute period. Tottenham, West Ham, another example. We're seeing more of those, and I think one of the interesting things about Liverpool City is whether there is going to be one of those sort of mad 10-15 minute periods where the entire complexion of the game changes. That's what makes it such a hard one to call.
On the subject of players who probably wouldn't press that well, well done to Vincent Janssen, who's won a treble in Mexico with Monterrey. Very pleased for him. And
did he play?
Who knows? We'll finish with this question from Barca Jim, a big friend of the pod. If the pod had to elect a president, who would it be? He said, I'm voting Wilson. Sean said the public would vote Barry in without a doubt. Andy says, Barry, no one should want the power. They should be put there to serve the people. I very much think Barry wouldn't want the power, brackets work. Who would you elect from the pod panel to be the president?
I'm going to go with Barney. I don't know if you remember when Reading got promoted to the Premier League. God, how many years ago was that? Brian McDermott and his players decided to start drinking their champagne before the press conference, and I was stranded in Reading, and it turned out that Barney lived not far from me and he drove me all the way home. So I'm going to go with Barney, because that's a good person with empathy, and that's something we need in this world.
He did that for me as well. Got a different reason, but during the 2011 riots, I lived in Camberwell. Right on Camberwell Green, and Camberwell Green was all cordoned off, and I had no, like, we were at a T20 cricket game in Hove, and because Camberwell was all rioting and unsafe and cordoned off, he let me stay in his spare room.
And he's driven you home, Max, from...
No, incorrect. After we got the ferry and the Beast from the East hit Ireland and we couldn't fly, I drove you, Barney...
Barry and Fisher.
Yeah, and... I had from Anglesey. Well, I drove to my house and then I left.
and then Barney
drove you home.
No, he didn't. He drove me to Brixton. He drove me to Barry's home, and then I had to get an Uber. So I was the only one who wasn't driven home that day.
Anyway, announce President Ronne.
Presidential qualities.
I just sorted myself out. I did drive you a long way.
No, you did.
I was quite tired. Anyway, that'll do for today's pod. Thanks for coming on. Thanks, Natasha.
No worries.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
That's right. Pleasure. Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers. Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.